Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm very excited. I've got Charlie on board with me today. Charlie, who have we got?
Oh, we've got a good one today. We've got Kat Hill. She's a senior lecturer at Birkbeck College in early modern history, and she's just as likely to be found walking in nature, taking stunning photos, which you can see on her Twitter feed, as she is to be buried in books, researching the rich history of the Mennonites. She's very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about these fascinating people today. So, hello, Kat. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. Hi, and thanks for having me on and giving me a chance to talk about the interesting Mennonites.
As you've all heard, Kat teaches at Birkbeck. I have not, I promise I've not been raiding the Birkbeck staff department again.
She's got a hit list. She's coming for you all.
See, we've got Kat on, now we're going to have Brody on. So Brody, if you are listening, you are next on my list. But this is really exciting. The reason is that when I got in contact with you, I was like, Mennonites, what? I contacted Alex. I said, Alex, what are Mennonites? We had to Google this because we had no idea where we were going with this. Something, it's historical, it's early modern. I'm like, what is this? So we're actually going to learn something, and I'm really excited to learn something. And it's not because we're going to be talking about a very interesting country that I have an association with,
Can't think what
Poland.
that would be.
Exactly. So let's start with this. First of all, can you tell us what Mennonites are for those of us who are completely clueless, and where did they come from?
Sure. It's not an unnatural reaction, I have to say, for people to say, what are Mennonites? What are you working on? So when I tell people what I'm working on, I normally say, well, you know, the Amish in America, they're a bit like them, and there are connections between the two groups, because Mennonites come from the early days of the European Reformation. So they spring out of radical movements that come out of the Protestant Reformation, a group known as the Anabaptists, who, as the name suggests, have very distinct ideas about baptism. They believe in adult baptism, not infant baptism. And Mennonites are one branch of this movement, and they're named after a guy called Menno Simons, who's the leader in the Netherlands. And they kind of spread from there and develop into a coherent movement, which has lasted right up to the present day, and kind of continuing those beliefs about elective membership of the church, being baptized as an adult, kind of quite strict ideas about discipline and morality. But they go right back to the 1520s, so a very long history.
Gosh. So we were going to talk specifically about the Mennonites and how they came to settle in Poland and Prussia. Were they able to have any kind of life there? And was it harder for them to be in the Netherlands and that region of the world? Was it easier for them in Poland and Prussia?
It's an interesting way to think about whether it's kind of easier or harder. I mean, I think one of the distinctive features of like Mennonite life is because they do have very distinctive ideas about morality and religion. They want to try and live separately and kind of set up their own communities, and that's not always possible. That's one of the reasons they go to Poland, what is modern day Poland, what was then kind of West Prussia, and there. In the Netherlands, they're sometimes tolerated, sometimes they're not. In the 16th century, lots of Anabaptists, the kind of origin group of the Mennonites, are persecuted. But in Poland, they are able to kind of negotiate agreements where they're able to live out their lives the way that they want. So because it's kind of a patchwork of territories, you've got lots of different lords. The city of what's then Danzig, Dansk now, is quite independent. And so the Mennonites are allowed to kind of set up their communities around there. And they also bring the added advantage. They're pretty good farmers, and they're very good at draining the land and making it arable land. So they have a use as well. So they are able to set up these kind of separate congregations there in a way that they haven't always been able to in other bits of Europe.
I've got a question just to throw in here. Were they actually allowed to buy property at the time?
No, they're not allowed to buy property within, well, not within the city walls of Danzig, which is kind of this, so this strange position of where they're allowed to settle on the outskirts, but they're not allowed to buy property within the walls, and they're not allowed to be citizens of the city. So there's this kind of like halfway house of tolerating, and this kind of recognition that they're different, but that they're allowed to settle and farm the land. So that tends to be quite common in their history. And it's not until kind of the into the 19th century that they're actually allowed to become like full citizens of the city.
I love that you say that they were also draining the land.
Yeah.
Being the fens myself.
Oh, really?
It's very useful technology that we... we nicked. Now there were two factions of Mennonites, right? Are there still two factions to this day, the Flemish and the Frisian?
In the 17th, 18th century, they split into, there are two groups in Prussia, Flemish and Frisian, and they disagree, not really over kind of religious matters, but about how to live their lives. So kind of questions of discipline, how strict the codes of morality should be, whether you ban people for certain things from the community, dress, that type of thing. And the names come from places within the Netherlands. But the Mennonites, those divisions do continue for quite a while, and Mennonites have many divisions now. So I would say it's not that those two divisions have continue to the present day, but there are lots of different Mennonite communities now who disagree over all sorts of things, and they're often splitting over these questions of how strict to be over life and how you live your life. So for example, if you go to a kind of modern day North and South America, in North America you've got pretty open liberal Mennonites who you would look at, and they, you know, you wouldn't know they're Mennonite to look at. You go down to South America today, and in places like Mexico, Paraguay, Belize, you have very traditional, what are called old order Mennonites who wear traditional dress, and they disagree with some of the kind of moral codes. So this division is not something new, and you can see it right back in the 18th century with these Flemish and Frisian divisions.
Gosh. So going back to the split, you know, from the Church of Rome and, you know, and the Reformation and all of these different sects coming up from, you know, out of Christianity, with the Mennonites, what did their mass look like? How did it differ from what they were trying to avoid?
They like most forms of Protestantism, I mean, there's all kind of varieties of how far this goes. They don't believe that the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Christ in any way. They say it's a simple remembrance. It's, you know, you're doing it to remember the Last Supper and remember Christ's promise of sacrifice. So for them, you don't need the high ritual that you would have in the Catholic Church. The priest is not, affecting a kind of transformation. He's not re-performing the sacrifice on the altar. And partly because of their belief in that, and partly through necessity, because especially in early days, you know, Mennonites are kind of doing things, you know, secretively or simply because they're having to live their lives in particular ways. The ceremony tends to be very simple and kind of imitates the Last Supper, so that you have, you know, simple bread, simple wine, though there are some communities that use milk as well rather than wine. And dip the bread in the milk. But it's arranged as a kind of a simple meal where, you know, people sit down and eat together, and they remember the discipleship and Christ and Christ's sacrifice. So it would look very, very different to how we would imagine a Catholic mass with its ritual and the senses and the smell and all of that. And they would sing psalms, and there would be a long sermon, but it'd be a very simple ceremony, stripped of all that kind of ritual significance that you would get in the Catholic Church.
So this really differed from, you know, the Anglican Book of Common Prayer and all of the rules that were being imposed in the, I'm thinking the 17th century, because, you know, I can't not go there.
Yeah, exactly. It does look very different from kind of high forms of Protestantism as well, and would look very different from a Lutheran Eucharistic, you know, communion, which, although, you know, there's not a belief in the same kind of transformation of the body into the body and blood, that there is a, you know, there's a ritual kind of richness to those ceremonies in, you know, the Anglican Church or the High Lutheran Church. You would have the altar, you have a priest who is, you know, distinct and different. Whereas here there's much more an emphasis on the kind of bond of fellowship between fellow believers and the simplicity and kind of recreating an apostolic kind of community. And I think you see that quite a lot in Mennonite ritual.
I'm really curious to know, did these two factions actually get along? Could they work together, or was there any sort of friction between them?
There is quite a bit of friction between the Flemish and the Frisian, and there's quite, they have distinct congregations for one thing. So if you went to in 17th century Danzig, you would have different churches. You'd have a kind of a Flemish church and a Frisian church, and they would have their own ceremonies. They perform ceremonies quite slightly differently. They have different rules about discipline. And so it's not generally advised that you marry across the Flemish and the Frisian communities in the 17th century, though that does happen. There are voices for kind of unity who say, well, this is, you know, we're all Mennonites, we should all kind of get along. But there is quite a bit of friction between these different communities, and going across to another one could be seen as kind of a betrayal of your community, and you could be expelled from, you know, the Frisians have slightly kind of harsher discipline code, and you could be expelled from that. And if you were following morals, which would be acceptable in a Flemish community. So, yeah, it does cause quite a bit of tension and disagreement, and families and communities do split over it.
So if I was to go from one church to another, if I was to go and visit the Flemish church one day and then to visit the Frisian, what differences would I see in the way that I was experiencing the religion in those two churches?
So as I say, the Flemish tend to be slightly less kind of strict on some of the questions of discipline. I mean, it would be hard to see perhaps kind of at the first glance, the visual difference. There'd be very similar ways in which these communities live their lives. But if you were to attend different ceremonies, then you would see the difference, that the way in which they perform the Lord's Supper, for example, the communion is different in the Flemish and Frisian. It's the Frisian ones you know, who think about using milk. The Flemish do it slightly differently. There'd be a different order. They would read different passages. So I think it's at the level of that detail that you would see the differences between communities. And as I say, there are many other splits as well. There are lots of splits between the Dutch and Mennonites too, over what they can do. So to an outsider, they might look quite similar. And of course, there are many more similarities probably between them than there are, you know, similarities with other religious groups. But if you were kind of to spend time with them and attend the rituals, there are quite distinct differences.
You mentioned the Catholics having their own rituals in church. We all know, you know, you go to church, mm-hmm. you sit down, you say a prayer, the priest does this, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm mm-hmm. proving to not be a very good Catholic right now because I don't even know how we operate. Please do not take notice of my bad Catholicism.
You're out.
I should get out of the Polish community too. No, anyway, moving on. So ritual is important in the Mennonite community. They've got their own rituals, and mm-hmm. baptism is one such important ritual. So mm-hmm. can you tell us, why is it so important to them, and what do we know, and what would it have looked like?
So yeah, baptism is crucial, and that goes right back to the early beliefs of that this is the kind of the core of these communities, of these congregations, because they make this really dramatic decision to reject infant baptism in the 16th century. It's why they're called Anabaptists, which literally means rebaptizers. And that might not look very radical to us. It might look, okay, well, that kind of makes sense because children can't, speak for themselves and they can't confess their own faith. But in the 16th century, that is incredibly radical because you believe that children are, have the taint of original sin when they're born. What happens to an unbaptized child? So baptism is really crucial for Mennonites because it expresses this different way of thinking about faith, that when you come to an age of what they call kind of reason or understanding, you make a kind of committed promise to join the church and to become part of the church. I mean, obviously in practice, if you're born into a Mennonite community as a little child, you're going to become a Mennonite probably, but still there's this importance of actually speaking the promise of becoming part of the community yourself. Again, I mean, the ritual would have been pretty simple. It's sometimes quite hard to get details on exactly how things happen. The documents that we have often are fairly limited. We have descriptions of Mennonites in the kind of 17th, 18th century. We have, letters and church books, but we don't have things like, someone who's being baptized giving us a really nice description of what it was like and what they felt like. But it would have been a profession of commitment to the faith with a series of questions asked by the preacher to the baptisms, those who are to be baptized, kind of testing them or checking that they know what they're doing, that they know their faith. And it's actually often, it seems to have been imagined a little bit like we would think of as a marriage ceremony today. So there's this, in this one account of the baptism ritual, there's this lovely moment which is described where all those who have been baptized have answered their questions, there's been a sermon, and then the preacher says, does anyone here have any objection to these people being baptized into this church? A little bit like, if anyone wants to speak now, speak now, forever hold your peace. It's that
kind of everyone clenches.
Exactly. It's like all the time. I'm sure it must have been a kind of a similar moment because this is a really important kind of rite of passage. It's a transformation from being a kind of half member of the church into a full member of the congregation. And with that, so you have this idea of the kind of community accepting these individuals. They don't immerse fully. There is water used, generally water kind of either drawn as a in the shape of a cross or drops of water, not full immersion in the 18th century. That does change later with some communities, but again, a very simple ritual which is about that confession of faith.
I mean, that's really very modern that we're talking about, this kind of idea of religious consent. But I just want to be dark for a minute because we are talking about the 16th and 17th century, even into the 18th, where child mortality is much higher than it is now. What was the logic or the provision for that? Because you say you're born with original sin. Is it just sorry, bad luck?
That's one of the most interesting questions I found in my research. It's actually what drove me to kind of look at the Anabaptists originally, because I was like, this isn't, as you say, it looks like a kind of quite, rational decision or easy decision, but it's actually a very profound emotional shift in saying, actually, we're going to reject him from baptism. And I think there's no easy answer to that. I mean, there are a variety of kind of accommodations, I would say, or changes that Anabaptist and then Mennonite communities make to kind of bridge that gap. I mean, I think certainly by the time you get to kind of 17th, 18th century Mennonites, there's a sense in which you're being born into a quite kind of separate congregation. And even though you have not yet been baptized, as a child of Mennonite parents, you are part of that community. When you get to the point where Mennonites have their own cemeteries, those children are buried in those cemeteries. On the question of original sin, and this again goes right back to kind of 16th century understandings of this with these radical religious movements. They come to the explanation that although children may be born with some original taint of sin, that sin can't have any effect until they are at an age of reason. So until they have, it's called Vernunft, is the German word,
Love it.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're vernumptig, if you have the ability to reason, then you can make a decision to sin or to be good. And it's only at that point that that sin becomes damning. And at that point, you baptize. It's not clear the age. So the ages vary quite a lot.
That's what I was going to ask. What age do we vrumpf?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you see it. You see kind of what we would still obviously consider children, perhaps more of an age of the kind of the age of Holy Communion, being baptized in the 16th century. But by the 17th, 18th century, really most Mennonites are not being baptized till late teens, early 20s, sometimes even in later. So I think by that point, there's this accommodation of both a different understanding of how sin operates and that children who aren't going to end up in hell or limbo or whichever version of kind of the damned part of the afterlife you work off, but also that, as I say, that they are part of the community by virtue of kind of growing up in a Mennonite congregation. So there are ways around that question. I think it's very interesting how it's part of the urgency about those questions which drives communities to kind of form congregations in the way they do. But it's a really interesting question about what parents feel if a child dies and it's 2 months old.
Charlie's brought up a good point. I really like that. But I'm curious about what if I was an external person, I don't know, Joe Bloggs from down the road, and I've fallen in love with a girl who was a Mennonite or you know, could I join the community? Is there a possibility for me to be baptized? And is it a common occurrence?
Really good question. And yes, you could. And it does happen that people baptize into Mennonite communities. And although Mennonites are supposed to be quite separate, they're, you know, obviously you can't live lives completely separately. So it does happen that there is marriage into Mennonites, and also the other way, you know, which is what Mennonites don't want, is that, you know, someone goes off to a Lutheran sermon and they end up in the Lutheran church. It isn't particularly common for a couple of reasons. One is that there are very strong bonds between Mennonite congregations and families which operate across very large distances. So although Mennonites go from the Netherlands to Poland, they're always traveling back and forth. You might well be a Mennonite in Danzig and you marry someone in Amsterdam or Haarlem, and you know go back and you find the wife or the husband there, and there are strong connections. So there's a very strong interconnection between these communities, and even between particular families within communities. And I think the other reason why you don't see it that often is because Mennonites are not really allowed to go out and evangelize, and also they don't really want to in the same way that other churches are. But they never, not until the 19th, 20th century, they're never really a mission church. So they don't go out and try and convert in the same way that you might see you know, Jesuits doing, or you might see the Moravian Brethren, who are kind of a parallel Protestant missionizing movement. So it does happen, and you do see it in the records. But it's not hugely common. But intermarriage, especially towards the 18th century, 19th century, is something which is becoming more common, I would say.
Gosh, it's incredible to hear how the community managed to find each other across geographic distances. With, you know, when we don't have the advantages we have now, like a, you know, a Twitter group or a way to find people. The other side of this is not people joining the community and all of that lovely stuff. Proving your faith was very important to the Mennonites as well, wasn't it? And I'm quite interested in hearing how people were punished if they didn't fall into line, or were they kicked out? Were people shunned and excluded from their community?
Yeah, exactly. That does happen. And I think the power, if you like, a counterpoint to baptism, which is this ritual of acceptance, is the power of the community to exercise what they call the ban, to excommunicate, to exclude people who don't fit within the kind of the rules of morality in the community. It tends to be the case that, I mean, full ban, full excommunication does happen.
Gone out.
Exactly, you're gone out, you're expelled. And
I don't want to see you anymore.
Yeah, don't want to see you, you're expelled, you're excommunicated, you're not part of the church. What tends to happen more often is a realization that that is a little extreme, and also, you know, the reality of day-to-day life, people do commit misdemeanors, you know, or they don't fit within the perfect model of what your moral codes demand. So that can be from, you know, maybe drinking, to wearing the wrong type of clothes, to sexual misdemeanors. So what more often happens as a kind of, you know, daily practice or normal practice is to exercise what they would call the little ban. That's shunning people for a while. So it's a kind of temporary exclusion. I'm sure that would have been pretty traumatic in itself, you know, kind of being the idea that you don't talk to people, or you are kind of ostracized from the community for a while. You couldn't receive communion or take part of rituals until the point at which you make a kind of an apology, an expression of guilt and regret in front of the elders in the community. And so that's a process where you exercise discipline, and you also you don't expel people all the time, but full expulsions do happen, and it is part of kind of the way in which it's a really important part of the way in which communities try and kind of keep this sense of otherness, this sense of difference, this sense of separation. There are lots of disagreements. Again, that's the how harshly you apply the ban is one of the things which all these different branches disagree about. And obviously, it's quite hard to kind of keep a check on what everyone's doing in different places. So, for example, the Danzig Mennonites are kind of the centre of West Prussian Mennonite life, and they have to discipline a deacon who's in a smaller community towards the east in someone called Königsberg, because he's wearing this Japanese gown with otter fur, which they're like, no, that's not, not Mennonite. So,
you know, that's horrible in itself. I mean, who'd want to wear that anyway?
I kind of want to see this gown. I want to see what it looks like.
Leave the otters alone. But there was sort of the chance to repent and to be forgiven.
Yeah, normally, unless it's something really bad. I mean, things, some particular crimes, you see it for things like rape, or, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, we read it is rape. It's not described necessarily as that in the records exactly. Or violent crimes, you could be excommunicated fully, and it does happen, but it's much rarer than using the little ban.
Sticking with these forms of rituals, because you know how Catholics like a ritual.
Yep.
And I'm not a very good one, so anyway, death and grief. I mean, I'm gonna throw in a personal experience here. Actually, I recently went to a funeral in Poland. And most of my funerals have been in England, and they're both Catholic, completely both Catholic, but they had totally, totally different rituals. I mean, so you even find it within Catholicism. But how would Mennonites deal with death, and what were their funeral rituals that followed a death within the community?
And death is, again, it's one of those things which plays a really interesting role in Mennonite communities, because there's this... if you go back to kind of say 16th century, like, dying a good death is really important because martyrs are really important to Mennonites. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not exactly a funerary ritual, but it's a death ritual, which is really important. But because Mennonites and Anabaptists are persecuted in the 16th century, the idea of dying the good martyr's death is something which kind of comes up quite a lot. So, you know, persecuted by Lutherans and Catholics alike, and going to your death, accepting of your fate. And, you know, these stories are immortalized in martyrological collections. The Martyr's Mirror is the most kind of famous of those, which Mennonites still use today, and is really important. So I think there's this going on in the background with death. I mean, in terms of, but of course, you know, not everyone can live die a martyr's death, because that doesn't really bode well for the future of the community if everyone is a martyr. So it's not something which you can sustain as a practice. But it is, I think, this idea of being accepting of fate and of suffering is important. With kind of more normal death, if you like, you know, kind of obviously just death in the community. Again, it can be hard to kind of pin down detail, and it's but certainly until the kind of 17th, early 18th century, when communities don't necessarily have big church buildings or their own church buildings themselves, and they are worshipping in barns and things, they're often actually having to share space with Lutherans and Catholics. So although they have their own ritual, their own funerary ritual, where again there'll be simple dress, a sermon said, singing of psalms, they'll actually have to use burial space in a Catholic, probably a Catholic ceremony in West Prussia, possibly a Lutheran one, because they don't have their own. That does change in the 18th century because they start to build their own churches and their own cemeteries. And I think that's a really interesting shift, actually, when they are able to separate themselves in death as well as in life. But it, again, it'd be pretty simple, no frills, the emphasis on living, you know, having lived a good life, being part of the community, even in death, and then kind of reflecting that in the sermons, which are said, and psalms, which are sung.
That's really nice. And it, you know, can't have been easy, because they were living and dealing with quite a lot of plague times. I can't imagine what that might have been like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Danzig community is hit by the kind of the last, what looks like the last wave of great plague in Europe in kind of 1709. It goes on longer across Europe, but yeah, that's really devastating for kind of Prussia as a whole. And I think it's something like, I mean, it's about half of the city in Danzig die, not just Mennonites, of course. And at those moments of kind of extreme, extreme trauma crisis, I mean, as we know now, it kind of affects the way that you interact with questions of mortality and death. And there's some really interesting, beautiful kind of case study of a father who loses his wife, he loses his son, and he writes this letter to his relatives in Altona, and he's describing how his son thinks he sees the ghost of his mother, and he has dreams where he imagines them all happy in the afterlife, and it looks pretty Catholic in its kind of imagining of the afterlife, but I think you can see something there of the trauma of an event where lots of people have died and just hoping, wishing to be reunited even in death. And so I think there's some really interesting ways in which you can kind of think about how death changes in meaning as well at times of trauma and crisis.
Gosh, that sort of coping instinct that we seem to have. How did the Mennonites cope with the world changing on them? Were they allowed contact with anyone outside their community, or were they insular?
They try to be quite separate, but the reality is, of course, you know, you can't be completely separate. That's not really the way that life functions. And they, you know, because they're good farmers, because they are very involved in the lace trade. That's one thing they do a lot in Danzig. They are interacting with communities, but they do try and keep quite separate. They're not supposed to have contact in the sense that intermarriage is definitely frowned upon. Sometimes they're allowed, if there's no church anywhere else, they're sometimes allowed to go to Lutheran services, but that is like, they're a bit worried about that, because like, what if they go to it and then they start converting into it? So there's a pragmatism about kind of the amount of contact, because you simply can't live your lives completely separately. But at the same time, trying to keep these bands of community. And it's often when those boundaries are threatened that Mennonites decide to move and that they migrate. So there are all sorts of agreements, as I said, that they have about toleration for their beliefs. One of the key things about Mennonites is they don't swear oaths, which is a fundamental part of early modern society.
Yeah.
If you think about guilds or oaths of loyalty to the city, or and increasingly into the era of nationalism, oaths to the nation, Mennonites won't swear oaths. They don't believe in military service. Though there are accommodations to that as well, but they don't want to fight in the military. So in the 18th century, by the later 18th century, as Prussia is under Frederick the Great, is becoming, you know, the Prussian state, where it's a military state. People are expected to kind of contribute to that, to fighting those armies. That the way of life that Mennonites have been granted is coming under pressure. And at that point, that's when many of them decide to migrate to what's modern day Ukraine, but was then part of the Greater Russian Empire, where they think, okay, well, we can renegotiate living our lives in the way that we want to, with toleration for our beliefs and our ways of conducting our lives. So they're always treading this line between living within a place and also kind of living outside it in this really interesting way.
So sticking to this whole idea of migration, because they're not just in Poland, they're not just in Prussia, Russia and the Netherlands. Making a list, nice little list here. Where else can you find Mennonite communities? Do any of them still exist in these places now? And can we find any traces of them or any buildings or anything that stands in these areas?
Yeah, Mennonites migrate a lot. So Mennonites are pretty much everywhere in the current day. I mean, that's a bit of an over-exaggeration, but they are a truly kind of global church now. And so the general pattern of migration is, as I said, Netherlands to Poland, to Ukraine, Russia. Many then go across the Atlantic in the 19th century to North America and Canada. Some go down to the Black Sea. And from North America, there have been further waves of migration to South America. I mentioned, you know, Paraguay, Belize, Mexico. And there have been missions in India. And now actually the greatest concentration of Mennonites is in the global south, in Africa. There are churches in Korea, in Indonesia. So now there are Mennonites everywhere now. The biggest concentration actually is now in the global south, though the most kind of famous place now where they are is North America. And, you know, that's where, as I say, when I say to people, oh, I'll work on people who are like the Amish, they're actually kind of close cousins because they both come from Anabaptist, the Amish, and the Amish are like a split off of Mennonites, basically, is we think of North America. So we think of communities like Amish or Old Order Mennonites who, you know, live traditional lives there. There aren't any Mennonites now in Poland at all. And they, not all of them go to Russia, to the Russian Empire in the 18th century. Quite a lot stay. Many of those communities actually end up fighting for Germany in the World Wars. But after the Second World War, the churches are destroyed, people are dispersed. I mean, obviously you can imagine it's a quite kind of problematic position for community, you know, the German-speaking community still in post-war Poland at a time when, you know, they may have moved as well and the question of kind of statelessness. So there are no Mennonites now in Poland, but there are material remnants of their lives. Kind of a really interesting research trip I did a couple of years ago, as I spent, you know, the 4 or 5 days before Christmas, as one does, driving around the Polish countryside and the northern Polish countryside looking for cemeteries of Mennonites, because there are still lots of Mennonite cemeteries. And, you know, it's very cold, very snowy, got stuck a few times, but I found the cemeteries that I wanted to. And those are really interesting because they have been looked off. Well, they fell into kind of ruin and disrepair, but they are now being restored, and Mennonites often come over from North America. They're looking for their ancestors. And so they're this kind of really interesting space. So yeah, there's lots of Mennonites if you want to find them. And there are lots of kind of traces of their lives across places they've moved as well.
I think, Charlie, you and I, you know, you could fly over and we're going to go and have a little bit of tour of northern Poland. And Kat's going to give us a nice little list of where we should go.
Can you get the good crook, Nick?
Whatever you like.
Gosh, it's really interesting to hear that, you know, that so much has survived from these communities. What would you say is their contemporary legacy today?
I mean, I think they offer still that their survival offers a really interesting kind of alternative narrative to the survival of faith, because they're still really, you know, they're kind of really strong numerically. There are, you know, there are lots of Mennonites, and there are lots of communities, as say, particularly North, South America and the Global South. And not all, as I say, but many of them live still these very traditional lives. I mean, some of them still only speak to each other in Low German dialects. They wear traditional dress. And if we tend, you know, we think of this, you know, ourselves in a world of, you know, secularization and, you know, decline of faith, perhaps in the Western world particularly. And yet you have these communities which have survived, and not just survived, but actually, you know, are still moving, migrating. And yet they're also different to the, you know, they're not part of the kind of the mainstream evangelical faith of the US either. They are their own distinct thing. So I think they're a really interesting legacy of the power of a kind of confessional diaspora, one which is still very powerfully connected between communities. You know, they have their own very strong sense of their genealogy and of their history. That can be deeply problematic as well. You know, this kind of looking back to a European, often white past, and that problem is you know, it which many men like themselves are aware of. So it raises for me all sorts of really interesting questions about belonging and faith, and the nature of community in the modern world.
You've got a really interesting project coming up, haven't you? Tell us about it. Tell us, what are you doing?
So this is a 5-year project funded by the Leverhulme. And the idea is to go well beyond my early modern origins. And this project is kind of called Global Faiths. And it's looking at these long-term questions of the survival, the development, the migration of not just Mennonite, but also their cousins, the Amish and the Hutterites, who as I say, all go back to Anabaptism in the 16th century. Their migrations, their dispersion, their survival, the development of their faith. So I will be hiring 3 postdocs and 2 PhDs onto that project next year. The big question for us is to think about exactly this question of how a dispersed community, one that often has moved, migrated, has, you know, not been tolerated, has grown into a very distinct kind of element of a global faith, how it's spread into the global south, what its material legacy is, what the archives look like for studying something like that, and how that really helps us think about big questions of diaspora, what migration means, what does secularization mean when you've got a church like this, and how do I think the biggest question for me that I'm really interested in is how we can think about kind of experience at the local community congregation level in big global landscapes and timeframes, because it always comes back to me for those kind of questions of individual experience, community experience. So yeah, it should be quite exciting, I hope.
that sounds so exciting. So for anyone who wants to follow your progress on this, where can we follow you on social media and keep an eye on what you're up to?
So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Catrician H is my Twitter handle. On my website, cathill.co.uk. As you say, so if I'm not posting nature photos, then I'll be
You're worth following even just for the nature photos. Do you promise you'll come back and talk to us again once you're properly into all this research?
I definitely will, of course. Yeah, it's been really fun to talk about it. So it'd be really exciting to kind of update you when I've done a bit more traveling and a bit more research.
we cannot wait to hear back from you. Thank you so much for joining us today, Cathill.
Yeah, thanks so much for a really, really interesting conversation.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.